Hey there, this is Mark Scarborough, and this is the podcast Walking with Dante, a podcast that is continuing to walk on the roadbed of the Terrace of Pride in Purgatorio. We're past the gate, we're into the first level of the penitence. There are many more ahead of us, much ahead of us, before we ever get even to the top of this thing and finally confront Dante's greatest fear, or perhaps love. Long before we get to that, we're here walking along the roadbed of the Terrace of Pride. Dante the Pilgrim is looking down at reliefs carved into the pavement below his feet, where it lines 49 through 60 of Canto 12 of Purgatorio. Again, just 12 lines. The final bits of the reliefs carved in the roadbed. This is going to be a similar episode compared to previous ones in that we'll look at who these are, we'll look a little bit at the craft here, we'll look at some curiosities, and then we're going to end up back at humility. This is my English translation. You can find it on my website, markscarborough.com or walkingwithdante.com. Let's finish off the reliefs. Now, the hard pavement showed the way in which Alcmaeon caused the unfortunate jewelry to appear not worth the price his mother paid for it. And it showed the way in which his sons fell on Sennacherib inside the temple, and how, having killed him, they left him there. And it showed the way in which Tomyris made ruin and cruel slaughter when she said to Cyrus, "You were thirsty for blood, I intend to fill you up with it." And it showed the way in which the Assyrians were routed and put to flight after Holofernes was killed and the remains of his slaughter were littered about. Well, that's a dramatic ending. Littered about remains of a slaughter. Good grief. These reliefs have gotten increasingly violent to the end. We'll talk about that more actually in the next episode of this podcast. Instead, as I said, we're just going to do the who, the how, the curiosities, and then humility as a whole in this episode. Let's get to it. The last of the carvings in the pavement of the Terrace of Pride. Let's start at the beginning with the who. Now, the hard pavement showed the way in which Alcmaeon caused the unfortunate jewelry to appear not worth the price his mother paid for it. This is coming out of Statius's Thebaid, we believe. There are several locations where this story could be found, but we think Dante's cribbing it from Statius, since some of these reliefs have been cribbed from the Thebaid already. This is, again, the great epic of the fall of proud Thebes. Alcmaeon is the son of Amphiaraus. We have already seen Amphiaraus. He was in Inferno, Canto 20, at lines 31 through 39. He was there with the fortune tellers or diviners, if you remember, and you don't have to. Amphiaraus predicted or foresaw the fall of Thebes. He ran away to hide. He was then drawn out into battle because he was betrayed, and he was killed, well, because a giant hole in the earth opened up and swallowed him whole right in front of Thebes. That swallowing was part of the story in Inferno. It's not here. It's just all backstory to here. What's actually here is not Amphiaraus, but instead his wife, Eriphyle. Now, Eriphyle has got a bit of a story going on, so let me tell it to you. Eriphyle, Amphiaraus' wife, is convinced that he's being a coward by not fighting for Thebes, so she essentially is good prey for Polynices to bribe her. He bribes her with a necklace, a very important necklace made by the god Vulcan for the goddess Harmonia. This is a storied necklace. Basically, she sees this beautiful thing and betrays her husband and then sends him out into battle by betraying his hiding place. He asks his sons, one of whom is Alcmaeon, to avenge his death, and that son then goes and kills his mother, Eriphyle. That's the whole story back behind here. The way in which Alcmaeon caused the unfortunate jewelry, that's that Vulcan necklace made for the goddess Harmonia, to appear not worth the price his mother paid for it. So we've got a little bit of an issue here. It's Eriphyle who is the exemplar of pride, not Alcmaeon. We've already seen his father in hell amongst the fortune tellers or the diviners. And here again, we have an example in which the lead figure is not exactly the exemplar. Just as we had with, if you remember, Apollo, Pallas Athena, and Mars, and Jupiter, all looking at the dismembered giants. A little funky because the exemplar, his mother, is buried inside the passage. Let's move on to the next figure. The pavement showed the way in which his sons fell on Sennacherib. This is the king of Assyria in the late 600s BCE. He besieged Jerusalem twice. The second time was the disaster. What we know from Tanakh, or the Old Testament from the biblical sources, is that in the second siege, Sennacherib showed up to confront King Hezekiah with 185,000 soldiers. And at a single moment, essentially, the angel of the Lord killed all 185,000 Assyrian soldiers. Sennacherib then goes flying back to his temple in Nineveh, and there, because of this vainglorious defeat or this absolute rout that he's endured, he is killed by his sons in the temple. We would say that Sennacherib is indeed an exemplar of pride because he is besieging, in the biblical record, God's kingdom under King Hezekiah, who is very much connected with the prophet Isaiah. Much of this story we find not only in the record of the kings in Tanakh, but also in the prophecies of Isaiah. Then moving on to the next, third exemplar, the pavement showed the way in which Thomeris, or if you want to pronounce her name in another way, Thamyris, Thomeris made ruin and cruel slaughter when she said to Cyrus, "You were thirsty for blood. I intend to fill you up with it." This is a particularly disturbing little story. Dante has gotten it most likely from Paulus Orosius, the priest and quote-unquote historian. In Orosius's telling of it, Cyrus, the founder of the Persian Empire, is killed in battle in 529 BCE. What happens is he attacks a group of people for whom Thomeris is the queen. She then assaults him, she captures him, she beheads him, and she puts his head most likely in a human bladder filled with blood. Told you, it's really disgusting. And she essentially gives this line in Orosius. The line, "You were thirsty for blood, I intend to fill you up with it," said to the head in the bladder, is a paraphrase of the line directly out of Orosius. So we think Dante is using that source for this story. Notice here that we have focused on the vengeance of a female figure. I think this is important because the whole list here ends with two females. So moving on to the last one, it showed the way in which the Assyrians were routed and put to flight after Holofernes was killed and the remains of his slaughter were littered about. Holofernes is an Assyrian general, and you probably know this story from ever so many Renaissance paintings. Judith essentially seduces Holofernes into her tent and then beheads him when he gets very comfortable. You'll notice that Judith is not in this passage. She's missing from it. She's hidden in much the way other figures are hidden back behind the scenes, the way, for example, Eriphyle is hidden behind Alcmaeon. Here, Judith is hidden behind Holofernes. He, of course, is the exemplar of pride. One other thing, the remains of his slaughter. We kind of assume that means his body parts, that Dante is pushing it a little. And it's not just that she beheads him, but that she dismembers him. We'll talk more about that in a minute, but you'll notice the last two exemplars end with beheadings. And think just for a minute about that before we pass on to the craft of the passage. Think about heads and what they mean for Dante. Not only are they the locus of the emotional affect, of the way you feel and present yourself to the world, but even Dante knows that there's something to do with rationality and mind there. And so the end stop game of pride is decapitation. It's losing your ability to, put it in Aristotelian terms, to reason. Think about that for a minute. It's really an interesting concept that pride stops you from reasoning. I mean, listen, usually pride spurs on a kind of hyper-analytical reasoning, a kind of unbelievable assertive reasoning. But in Dante's telling of it, it has a whole different feel about it, that pride can actually decapitate reason. Is that a way to say it? I'm not quite sure exactly. But that it can actually take the head off of reason itself, and maybe that's the end game here. Let's move on off that and on to the subject of the craft of the passage. You'll notice that the first two figures are children killing their parents. We have Alcmaeon killing his mother because of that necklace with which she was seduced into betraying her husband and his father. And then in the second example, we have Sennacherib's sons killing him. So we have two bits of children killing their parents. And then we have two women killing warlords, or actually two women committing almost regicide. Hall of Fairness isn't really a king, but he certainly is a warlord. Children killing their parents, women killing arrogant warlords. And while we might see a proto-feminist statement here, and you could probably argue this, we should also think about the way women are treated in Dante's day, the misogyny that runs around the cultural rubric. And there is a kind of way in which these great warlords are put to rout by women, thus fully humiliating them. Ugh, I know, I'm sorry, that has just so much gross misogyny in it. But if we just step back from what we know and think back to Dante's context, we would say that these guys are completely humiliated because they're done in not by other warriors or even their own children, but instead by women. Oh, I know, gross. But okay, let's talk more about the craft in the passage. Notice that part of what happens in the movement of the passage is we have kind of sacerdotal images or really sacred godlike moments, the jewelry made by Vulcan, or Sennacherib in his temple praying after his defeat. These are very sacred, sacerdotal, pagan admittedly, but sacerdotal moments, and they give way to just bloody slaughter. And the whole thing ends in kind of a really disgusting bloodbath. I think that's really important to watch us move from sacred to really profane. I know, pagan sacred, but remember, Dante has a weird relationship with that pagan sacred, thinking it a precursor of Christian thought. And then finally, another way to look at the craft of this passage is that we have an occluded figure, Eriphyle, and then we have a presented victim, Sennacherib, and then we kind of again have a bit of an occluded victim, Cyrus, because although he's mentioned in that tercet, he's not the point. Instead, it's Tomyris's big statement. You were thirsty for blood. Now I'm shoving your head in a bladder and I'm going to fill you up with it. He's there, but he's not the focus of the tercet. So occluded, presented, occluded, and then occluded in another way at the end. That is, Judith is missing from the passage and it focuses on Holofernes. So the agent of the vengeance is occluded there. In Alcmaeon, the agent of the vengeance is foregrounded. In the final one, the agent of the vengeance is hidden. This could be for several reasons. It could be a misogynistic problem on Dante's part. You know, hey, I'm not beyond saying that. But it also could be that Dante wants to occlude the final final agent of vengeance there, Judith, because he wants to focus on Holofernes. He wants to make sure we understand that this has really all been about pride, despite the fancy dancing he's done throughout all of these exemplars, 12 of them. We've been working through 3 episodes at 4E10. There are actually more than 12 if you think about Pallas, Athena, and Mars, and Apollo, and Jupiter in one, and then Nimrod with his crowds, and maybe there are even crowded battle scenes in some of them, but essentially 12 tercets that make up these exemplars themselves. I think Dante wants to end it here with a very strong moment in which we see someone brought low because of pride, because Holofernes thinks he can defeat the, to put it in the terms of Tanakh, the children of God. He thinks he can defeat them, and Judith is going to put an end to that. Let's look at a few curiosities inside this passage. The first is that Eriphyle and Judith are not named. Eriphyle is really missing in the opening tercet here. She's not even, well, his mother is mentioned, but I mean, she's really behind the scenes. And if we think about it, Lucifer was also not named at the beginning of the stretch of exemplars. I think that's probably important to signal us that we're reaching a conclusion, since we started with Lucifer or Satan not named, and then we kind of ended with Judith, the agent of vengeance, not named, although the exemplar Holofernes is named. I think also if you look at the first line of the passage we're on, there's a curiosity here. Now the hard pavement showed the way in which Alcmaeon caused the unfortunate jewelry, blah, 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 blah. Let's just stop on hard pavement. Is there something allegorical or symbolic about duro, about hard here? If we think through these exemplars for the last couple episodes, they are getting bloodier and bloodier. Is there some way in which pride hardens, that it becomes over time increasingly destructive and increasingly bloody? Oh, there's a question for Dante's war-torn days and for our war-torn days. Is there ways in which pride becomes increasingly hard in an allegorical or a metaphoric sense? And it says the hard pavement. Pavimento. These reliefs are carved into paving stones or pavement in some way and not into marble. The intaglios of humility were in the gorgeous marble along the edge of the terrace, the mountainside edge of the terrace. These are in paving stones, and that difference is really important, because you're not going to put the exemplars of pride in a precious stone. Sennacherib is also a curiosity in the passage, because Sennacherib is a stand-in for Satan in much Christian thought. The passages in the prophecies of Isaiah, whether written by Isaiah or subsequent prophets, it doesn't matter, collected now into the prophecies of Isaiah, often refer to Sennacherib as a figure of great haughty pride. And later Christian traditions, particularly in the 2nd century Common Era and thereafter, begin to interpret those passages as references to Lucifer or Satan, this high and mighty figure who thinks he's better than God. They probably directly refer to Sennacherib and other local warlords like him, but he is often a stand-in figure for Lucifer, and so that he's occurring here toward the end is an interesting little bit. I don't know if Dante is aware that those passages in Isaiah that often refer to Sennacherib are retranslated into interpretations of Satan by Christian scholars. I doubt Dante knows that. I think he probably thinks those passages are about Lucifer. But still, nonetheless, it's a cue here, perhaps, to wrap us up and to bring us toward an end. And finally, the last line of the reliefs themselves has a most remarkable phrase in it. There's Holofernes. He's been beheaded by Judith. And it says the remains of his slaughter were littered about. It's that the remains of his slaughter, if I literally translated that from the medieval Florentine, it would read the relics of his martyrdom. Now, listen, you can't talk about an exemplar of pride and refer to the relics of his martyrdom. Again, I think this is probably the pieces of his body. Dante really wants us to see that Judith goes all the way to dismember Hall of Fairness, to have it as stated as the relics of his martyrdom is very strong and assertive. In fact, we would say that this is deeply ironic. It's practically blasphemous. But is there a way in which these paving stone reliefs are a form of relics? Do they push you on to understanding divine truths the way relics are supposed to? If so, it's still a hard phrase to use, because relics of martyrdom is it's an incredibly positive thing in Dante's day, particularly as relics are becoming increasingly venerated. So that it ends there is dark, sardonic. It always strikes me as so wild. Dante, don't use language like that here. Say something else. Say the torn bits of his body. Don't use words that are quite so highly charged. And yet he does. And it really brings the passage into focus. It brings it into focus in terms of perhaps Dante's overarching prideful irony in some of the curiosities in the passage, the way he changes some of the stories even back to the exemplars of humility in the intaglios. And it also lets us know that this, even here, pride is a sacred space. I think that's really important for Dante. Let's pass on from this passage and talk just one more time about humility. We've talked about it as an emptiness, a loss, a lack, a void, a way that you're trying to make a void or a lack into a virtue. We've talked about the ways that you can make it actionable, but you probably have to connect it to love, which Dante will eventually do. And this is the way you can turn a lack like purity or patience into actually a virtue, because love is always actionable. I want to say one more thing, and this doesn't really have anything to do with Dante. This is a larger philosophical discussion. Self-effacement is probably an evolutionary development for a communal species. It's a tool of power, without a doubt. Self-effacement is the way the powerful get the humbled to understand their place, and they get those below them on the power structure to understand that they shouldn't, in fact, rise up and question the power structure by making humility a virtue. Of course, we can do all that kind of pseudo-Marxist take on humility. Maybe there's also an evolutionary bit to why humility is so often a virtue, not only in Christianity, but in Buddhism. Self-effacement, big time, right? In Hinduism, in Islam, in religions across the world, we see humility or self-effacement held up as a virtue. And maybe there's an evolutionary node here. We are a communal species. We are, to use a very loose and inaccurate term, a pack animal. That's why we like dogs so much. Well, I know some of you like cats, but humans have for a long time liked dogs because there's a way in which dogs behave similarly to the way we do. Not exactly, but we can kind of understand the pack behavior of dogs. We are communal animals evolutionarily, and so humility actually helps mitigate the chaos of a communal animal. You just think about this for a moment. If you have a pack of animals and everyone's in charge, everybody's the lead dog, everybody's the lead wolf, then you have nothing but chaos. Have you ever been in a work situation like this where everybody seems to be in control? My life in publishing is essentially this story. You walk into a meeting and there's all these people sitting there and you think, whoa, who's in control? And you suddenly find out they're all in control and the meeting lasts 3 hours because nobody is actually in control, and it's just a nightmare.
There is a way in which humility mitigates the chaos of a communal animal, a communal species. If some members of the species practice self-effacement, even momentarily, perhaps not as a lifestyle like the, you know, poor wolf at the back of the pack, but if you momentarily practice self-effacement, it mitigates the chaos of cortex-dominated communal animals. Maybe there's an evolutionary benefit to this, and maybe we should all take away from this idea that, in fact, at times, it's best to shut up. At times, it's best to sit with the homeless men. At times, it's best to listen to the message being delivered to you. Maybe it doesn't have to come even from divine sources. Maybe it comes from your spouse or your friends. Maybe there are times when you should just listen. I can't tell you how important I am finding this in my, current health crisis and also moving forward in my life. It's really important for me to keep an open mind and listen and not feel like I have to be in charge of everything that's happening to me. I do have to be in charge, and I do finally have to make the choices. But in order to make those choices, I also have to be quiet and listen to the people around me, what they're noticing about my behavior. You're increasingly anxious. What they're noticing about the way I'm responding, how I'm hearing it. As my husband will say, we'll be in an appointment, and he'll say, I don't think you heard that quite right. I think it was this way, and we'll talk it out. And it's really important for me not to jump up and say, no, of course I heard it right, but to listen to him and think, oh, is he right? So again, self-effacement, in fact, has a purpose of controlling chaos and pulling it together. It's not that you can't eventually get in control. It is that you can kind of negotiate your stance as a member of a communal species through humility. Well, and enough to be said, I'm not going to reread this passage, because in the next episode of this podcast, we're going to read all of these reliefs in one fell swoop, plus the final tercet, which I have lopped off at this point. But we'll get to that final tercet and all of them in one big sweep in the next episode. I just find that these are often blipped over and occluded because there's a little bit of it that I've hidden from you. So we're going to talk about that next time, what I've kept in abeyance during this entire discussion, why I've kept it in abeyance, and what, in fact, Dante may be doing with all of these reliefs in the paving stones. To get there, you have to subscribe to this podcast, rate it, you know, do all those things. If you write a review, I really appreciate it. It's fantastic help to the podcast itself. Thanks for all of you who are along with the journey with me. I am loving the walk, and I have to confess, I'm loving Purgatorio even more than I did before. I want to tell you, it was always my favorite part of the poem, and it's become even more so the more I work with it and the more we walk with Dante together. I'm Mark Scarborough, and I will see you soon.